I ended my last program by saying, quote, "The basic premise of situational ethics, which is that moral decisions are subjective, situational, and personal, cannot stand. Society survives through norms and laws, and any scheme which denies this is doomed to failure. Even those who deny general norms are quick to impose their own norms when given the power and the opportunity. Witness the power of political correctness in our colleges, universities, and places of business. Thus, the issue facing us is not whether there will be norms, but whose norms they will be. Will they be the norms of our Judeo-Christian heritage or those of secular humanism? We are being lulled into a false complacency that society can either be normless or have multiple norms concerning the same behavior, which, if you think about it, means the same thing. Where there are many norms, there is no norm, because the word norm, according to the dictionary, means standard or model for doing something. However, in one sense, there could be many norms for the same activity, and in another sense, there couldn't. Let me explain. In previous programs, I had talked about St. Thomas Aquinas' distinction between primary and secondary purposes. This is one of the most valuable tools for logical thinking that I have ever learned, and every child, especially those who go to Catholic schools, should be taught it. Let me summarize for those who might be tuning in for the first time St. Thomas's analysis. It goes something like this. A thing is good or bad, objectively speaking, according to how well it serves the purpose for which it was created. Thus, a good eye sees, a good ear hears, good food nourishes, etc. However, a problem arises because most, if not all, things could have multiple purposes. For example, eyes by winking can be used for communication. Ears can be used to hang ornaments, such as earrings, and food can be used simply for the pleasure of taste. Therefore, says St. Thomas, we have to distinguish between the primary or real purpose and the other purposes which are secondary. Whenever someone creates something, he always has a primary purpose in mind. Thus, we could conclude that the primary purpose always comes from the creator of the object. However, the creator could also include secondary purposes. For example, the creator of the Swiss Army knife included many other functions besides its function as a knife. Thus, we could conclude that both primary and secondary purposes can originate with the creator. However, those who use an object might invent other secondary purposes which the creator of the object did not intend. Thus, I might take the Swiss Army knife and, by grabbing it by the blade, use it as a hammer on a thumbtack. From this, we can further conclude that secondary purposes can also come from the user of the object. Thus, the issue comes down to this. If a thing is good or bad according to how well it serves the purpose for which it was created, how can we evaluate anything that has multiple purposes? St. Thomas's answer is, secondary purposes are all right so long as they either help or at least don't interfere with the primary purpose. What a principle for logical analysis, and it is a principle that all creators intuitively follow when they are creating. The maker of the Swiss Army knife had to weigh each minor function against his primary function when he was designing the knife, and he had to make certain that its function of being a screwdriver didn't interfere with his primary purpose of being a knife. In addition, when I decided to use it as a hammer, I was under the same obligation. If the blade snapped or the casing cracked when I used it as a hammer, then I violate the logical rule for the proper use of the object. Now we can add on another logical principle. The primary purpose, which comes from the creator, is the normal use for the object. All other purposes are abnormal uses. For example, the scissors in a Swiss Army knife might work in some minor instances, but if you have some serious work to do, you need a pair of scissors which were designed for that purpose. We could further conclude that the primary purpose, which comes from the Creator, is the major objective purpose, and it is the same for everybody, while those secondary purposes, which come from the users, are subjective and vary from person to person. Thus, the primary purpose for the eye is seeing, for the ear is hearing, and for food is nourishment. And this is objectively true for everyone, and these are the objective norms against which they are to be evaluated. However, when it comes to secondary purposes, such as winking, wearing earrings, or taste, these are subjective and vary from person to person. And as St. Thomas said, they are all right so long as they either help or don't interfere with the primary purpose. Thus, there is only one norm when it comes to the objective primary purpose, which is based on facts, but there can be many norms when it comes to the subjective secondary purposes, which are based on feelings. And whenever anyone violates the primary purpose of the creator of an object, he misses the mark by misusing it. And if that creator happens to be God, then the person is sinning against the wisdom that created the universe. That is why the secular humanists, in order to get rid of sin, had to get rid of God, the creator, because without a creator, there are no objective primary purposes, and therefore no sin. All purposes would be subjective and secondary, and the guiding principle would be different strokes for different folks. Parents, if you want to raise your children to be rational, moral human beings, then teach them what I just told you. The Bible says that wisdom, who is Jesus, is more valuable than the finest gold and the most precious gems, and what St. Thomas has given us in this analysis is a pearl of great worth, which, according to the Bible, a person should go and sell everything that he has to purchase it. And here, God, through St. Thomas, is giving it away for free. It is wisdom that the prophets in the Old Testament is referring to when, speaking in the name of God, he said, "Why do you spend money for food that doesn't satisfy, and for drink that doesn't quench your thirst? Come in for free, I will give you bread that will satisfy your hunger, and drink that will quench your thirst." And this is also what Jesus is referring to when he says, "I am the bread of life. You who come to me shall not hunger, you who believe in me shall not thirst, and unless you eat my body and drink my blood, you will not have life within you." He is simply reiterating the ancient Jewish belief that the inner man or soul ate wisdom, and since he was the incarnate wisdom of God, he created the Eucharist so that we could feed our souls with himself. Thus, a Christian life should be one of seeking and knocking at the door of truth, because only it can set us free from the kingdom of mental darkness. As Christians, we should not be afraid of the truth if we sincerely believe Jesus when he says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And we shouldn't be afraid to update or deepen our understanding of God's creation whenever human knowledge expands. Often things that first look threatening to our belief system later prove to enhance or support it. This seems to be true in terms of some of the more recent discoveries in science, especially those that undermine the concept of absolute laws. Before 1927, our physics was based on the theories of Sir Isaac Newton, who in 1666 described the universe based on absolute laws. This was very pleasing to the churches because it suggested that God, the absolute lawgiver, was totally in control of everything in the universe from the atom up. However, as often happens, the good news turned into bad news when some thinkers start to point out that if the atom was not free, then anything composed of the atom could not be free. This led to the philosophy of determinism, which said that everything had to do what it had to do, and if there was a creator of the universe, he was an absolute dictator who did not permit any of his creation to deviate from his will. Therefore, there was no such thing as free will. And if there was no free will, then how could any of us be held morally responsible for what we did? When I pulled the trigger on the gun that shot you, it was my atoms that made me do it. In fact, in an absolute world created by an all-powerful absolute dictator, there was no sin because there was no opportunity to deviate. This totally contradicted our idea of God, who, according to the Bible, is love, which is patient and kind and does not seek its own way. It also contradicted the whole theory of free will upon which the entire concept of sin rested. The universe described by Newton was based on order and was totally lacking in freedom. Thus, up until 1927, science believed that the laws of the universe were absolutes, and then came along a physicist named Werner Heisenberg who developed Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy, which claimed that the laws of the universe were not absolutes, but rather were based on statistical probability. Basically, what he said was that these laws could be demonstrated and validated only when they were applied to groups, not to individual items. Thus, physics can measure and tell what a group of atoms will do, but it can't measure or tell us what one individual atom will do. Thus, the only conclusion that we can draw about the behavior of the atom is based on statistical probability. According to Peter Zollinger, a longtime science reporter, in his book The Political Animal, what Heisenberg's law suggested was that physical beings, like atoms, and social beings, like people, follow the same type of laws. In other words, it has long been known that the rules governing the prediction of human behavior are based on statistical probability. Thus, we can predict how middle-class Catholics will vote in the next election, but we can't tell how any individual Catholic within that group will vote. There is always the possibility that some of them will deviate from the norm. Now it appears that the same is true about atoms. In both cases, we can predict only what the group will do, but not what individuals within the group will do. There is always the possibility that some individual might deviate from the group's behavior or norm. Thus, the best we can say is that most Catholics will probably vote in some particular way, or that most atoms will probably behave in some particular way. Therefore, it appears that our universe is not only composed of order, but also of freedom. And even though the churches were slow to realize it, Heisenberg's theory was more compatible with our concept of God than was Newton's. Let me give an example that I used with my seniors in high school, which demonstrates how statistical probability works. I would say to a student in the class, "James, I want to know how far human beings spit." You always pick something disgusting or gross if you want students to remember it. Next, I would say, "Suppose James goes out in front of the school and meets an 86-year-old lady with loose false teeth and emphysema. He asks her to spit, and she spits 1 foot. He reports back to me his findings, and I say that this can't be right. It's too short. So I send him out again. This time he meets a big, barrel-chested truck driver who spits 20 feet. Again, I tell him that this can't be right. It's too long. The truth is that he has reported to me two extremes, the extremely short and the extremely long. The only way that we can answer the question of how far do human beings spit is to test a whole lot of them, and when we do, we will discover that a statistical curve will be formed in the shape of a bell. This is called the bell curve or normal curve. Now let me warn you that from this point on, I need your full attention and imagination to describe what follows, because it is very visual, and I am attempting to do this through the medium of radio. If this were TV, I could draw the curve for you. It might help you to draw it yourself. Imagine a bell with long sloping sides extending out from the top center of the bell. The top center of the bell represents the middle point between two extremes. Let's draw a line down from that point to the base, splitting the bell in half, and let that line represent the average or norm. The left base of the bell is the extreme in one direction, and the right base of the bell represents the extreme in the other direction. Thus, using our spitting example, the little old lady who spat 1 foot represents the extreme to the left, and the truck driver who spat 20 feet represents the extreme to the right of the norm. The center point, which probably represents about 10 feet, is the normal distance for average human beings. Notice also that because the bell slopes as it moves away from the center point, that the number of cases decreases the further you move away from it. Thus, the further you move from the norm of 10 feet, the fewer are the number of people who spat either shorter or farther than the norm. And the closer you move towards the midpoint or norm, the greater are the number of cases. So how far human beings spit is not an absolute number. It is a statistical probability. Hoping that you are still with me, let me proceed. Now let's apply this to a moral law, keeping in mind that morality is just another name for rational behavior designed to reach rational ends. Society, if it hopes to survive, has to replicate itself into the future. It does this through the mechanism of sexual reproduction. However, reproduction is not enough. The offsprings not only have to be born, they have to be protected, nourished, and trained until they are able to assume an adult role in their society. This is especially true for our own species, since our children are not born with a lot of preset instincts like other animals. We are born as undeveloped and helpless creatures who need years of care and training. Brain scientists say that the animals are born with hardwired brains, which means that most of the neural connections are already hooked up at birth. Human children, on the other hand, are born with softwired brains, in which a significant number of neural connections are hooked up after birth by the caretakers of the baby. Thus, every culture can write its code for survival into the child's mind by hooking up these neural connections according to the demands of the culture. In fact, we could take a newly born Eskimo baby and place it in a Watusi tribe in Africa, and the African mother would wire the child's brain to be a Watusi. Experience, which according to the Bible is the source of wisdom, has taught us that although the females of some species, whose young come pre-wired, can raise the young by themselves, human females need help during the long developmental period of their infants. Thus, the divine light of intelligence within us, the left lobe, tells us that human sexuality has to be regulated by a social institution called marriage in order to assure that most children will be raised in a stable family, because experience has also taught us that most children thrive better in such a family. However, this fact is a statistical probability because it is possible that some children will not thrive in a stable family. Thus, sometimes wonderful families produce very mixed up children, and other times some great children develop from chaotic conditions. However, in both instances, the chances are possible, not probable. Therefore, in order to assure the greatest number of stable families, society and divine wisdom sets marriage as the norm for human sexual interaction. So let us draw a line down from the center of our bell and write on it marriage to indicate that it is the norm which will best assure the greatest number of stable families. If we lived in the universe of absolute laws, then any time this norm was followed, we would have a warm, nurturing, stable family which produced wonderful, acculturated children. And any time we violate the norm, we would produce an unstable, chaotic situation which would produce terribly maladaptive ones. However, in a universe based on statistical probability, it is possible, but not probable, that you could get the opposite results. Let me illustrate. Let's deviate to the left from this marriage norm by having an engaged couple have sex the night before the wedding. Technically, they have sinned by violating the norm, and society might be a little upset, but its basic concern is, what are the chances that the bride-to-be gets pregnant and the groom-to-be backs out of the wedding? The obvious answer is, it's possible, but highly improbable. Therefore, society doesn't approve, but it also doesn't get bent totally out of shape. In some cultures, sex can take place during the engagement period because it is almost as binding as the wedding. In other words, this moral law has a rational end, and that is why deviating from it is considered to be a sin or missing the mark. Now let's deviate a little further down the curve. Now we have a formally engaged couple who have already reserved the church, hired the photographer, hall, and caterer, and have a down payment on their house, and they decide to have sex 1 year before their wedding date. Once again, society's question is, what are the chances that she gets pregnant and he backs out of the marriage? This time, the possibility is greater, but it still seems improbable. Thus, society is bent a little more out of shape because of the shifting odds. Let's deviate again. This time, the couple is living together. There is no formal engagement and no plan or preparation for the wedding. He tells her that he is not ready to settle down, but that at some unspecified time in the distant future, he intends to marry her. Foolish girl. Now the answer to the question is, not only is it possible that she will get pregnant and he will fail to fulfill his husbandly and fatherly commitment, it is quite probable that he won't. Now, let's deviate even further from the norm of marriage. Now we have a teenage boy of 17 and a girl of 14 who are madly in love with each other and decide to express it sexually. They are hunting out of season because the relationship has nowhere to go. Neither is employed or capable of setting up any type of home or family. What are the chances that she gets pregnant and neither he nor she is able to provide the stable, loving family that the child needs, it is not only possible, it is statistically highly probable. We could continue to deviate from the rational norm of marriage. For example, here is a young girl who knows only one way to say thank you. Every time a boy treats her to anything, she feels obligated to pay off in sex. Or here is another girl who is attracted to guys with fancy and expensive cars. She gets into them and becomes intimate with the drivers. What are the statistical chances that either of these girls will become pregnant without any commitment from the fathers to help them raise the child? If you are a betting person, bet on the fact that they will. The laws of statistical probability are with you. Notice that the further we deviate from the norm, the greater is the probability that the negative consequences will occur. Notice also that it is not impossible for the girl who deviates the greatest to end up with a perfect marriage, or for the one who doesn't deviate from the norm to end up with a rotten marriage. However, it is highly improbable. Notice once again that the deviation from the norm is just another word for sin, assuming that the norm is based on rational grounds. So what this seems to indicate is that, in this universe, it is possible to sin and sometimes get away with it, that is, to not receive the predicted negative consequences. However, the more often you do it, or the more people who are involved in doing it, the more certain it is that the laws of probability will catch up with them. Thus, someone will say to you, "Don't go through a stop sign or you'll have an accident." You respond, "I went through one this morning and I didn't have an accident." The proper counter response is that if you keep on doing this, you'll eventually have the predicted accident, or if enough people start to do the same thing, the chances for you all having the accident will increase according to the laws of statistical probability. This is not an argument or justification for breaking the norm, simply because you can sometimes beat the odds, because every time people violate the norm or law, they weaken it, especially if they violate it publicly and without shame. These norms are created to provide for the common good, and only a fool would undermine the common good because he will have to live with the consequences. Thus, to sin is to break the norm or law, but to sin blatantly and publicly is to weaken or destroy it. This is what the church calls the sin of scandal. Every norm creates a social pressure which pulls people in the direction of the norm. Sociologists call this peer pressure, and it is one of the most effective and subtle ways of controlling behavior. Advertisers use it all the time when they try to create a bandwagon effect by trying to convince the consumer that everybody who is anybody wants to use their product, and the constant creation of fads and new styles seems to prove the successfulness of this technique. Although we like to tout ourselves as rational beings who think for ourselves, the evidence seems to indicate that much of our behavior is based on monkey see, monkey do. The younger and more immature we are, the truer this seems to be. Just watch how children and teenagers try to mimic the dress and behavior of the latest rage in the entertainment industry. So we are only fooling ourselves when we claim that we are unaffected by the pull of the crowd or social norms. I like to refer to this as the fish effect because years ago I saw a documentary in which scientists were trying to determine how fish that traveled in large schools seemed to all change direction at the same time. Was there a leader fish in the middle of the school who shouted out orders like a drill sergeant, "To the left flank march, to the right flank march, to the rear march"? To investigate this phenomena, they used slow motion pictures, and to their surprise they discovered that not all the fish were swimming in the same direction. Those on the outer edge of the school were deviating all the time. Each fish seemed to be drawn in the direction of the other fish that he was watching. If one of the fish on the edge of the school took his eyes off of those in the school, he might start to wander in a different direction. If, however, as he moved away from the school, he suddenly saw that he was separated from it, he darted back to the safety of the group. But if, as he strayed away from the school, others in the school saw him, they would begin to follow. The larger the group that followed him became, the greater was its pull on the rest of the fish in the school. What was really happening was a mathematical equation in which the larger the number moving in one direction, the greater was its pull. Interestingly, it almost sounds like how gravity works. Physicists say that the greater the mass of a body, the greater is its gravitational pull. And this is the way that norms work. Because they set the standards for group behavior, they exert a social pressure on everybody to conform. It doesn't matter whether everybody conforms, because there will always be deviations. What really matters is whether most of the group conforms. Well, I see that my time is up, and there are still other insights that we can draw from the bell or normal curve. In my next program, I will show how our children are committing the only unforgivable sin.